And I know it's gonna be a lovely day. Welcome to Amplified Houston on 90.1 KPFT Pacifica Radio in Houston, Texas, 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and streaming online at kpft.org. Amplified Houston is a collaboration of five nonprofit organizations: Baker Ripley, Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Houston, Children at Risk, the Women's Home, the Houston Food Bank, and Houston's community radio station, KPFT Pacifica Radio. Listeners, all the programs you hear on KPFT are listener-supported. Become a sustaining member today by calling 713-526-5738 and pressing option 1. I am your host, Anna Coffey, and it is my pride and privilege to serve as the CEO of the Women's Home. And this is Amplified Houston, the Women's Edition, where we talk to women doing hard things. In today's show, we'll speak with Kimberly Williams, CEO of Interfaith Family Services in Dallas and principal at Kim Williams Consulting, LLC. But first, Amplified Houston is supported in part by The Cottage Shop, a thrift store located at 811 Westheimer in Houston. It's owned and operated by the Women's Home, and proceeds from The Cottage Shop help pay for women for programs that help women reclaim their lives. Further information can be found at thewomenshome.org/cottageshop. Let's get on with the show. Kim, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, let's get started. So first, tell us about your work at Interfaith Family Services, and then I'd love to hear more about Kim Williams Consulting.
Okay, awesome. So for the last 15 years, I've been the CEO at Interfaith Family Services in Dallas. We help families in crisis break the cycle of poverty, primarily single moms that are at risk for eviction. That's our target demographic. And we provide transitional housing through on-site apartments that we have. We also provide rent assistance, and we pair, whether it's rent assistance or transitional housing, with financial coaching, career coaching, and an on-site childcare center for kids 6 weeks to 17.
So, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So we have all those services on one site. And our goal is really to provide what people need in crisis to not only survive the crisis, but to live stably long-term. And that's what we've been doing for over 40 years.
Kim, are most of your women fleeing domestic violence, or is it any kind of crisis that they run into?
It's primarily financial crisis. So it's a job loss. It's an illness. We have some people that have divorced. We do have people that have fleed domestic violence as well. But because we're not a secure property, what we typically are the next step after someone has completed a program at an organization that specializes in that.
I see. Okay, great. All right, let's hear about Kim Williams Consulting.
Okay, so since 2002, I have also provided change management consulting for nonprofits. I started my career working with the HUD initiative designed to help families go from welfare to work. And we did it at a small apartment complex that was a public housing complex. And I did good work there. And so HUD asked me to start going around and teaching other centers and other neighborhoods how to produce similar results. And that just kind of launched my consulting career. I love consulting because in addition to my work as a CEO of a nonprofit, it gives me an opportunity to expand my influence, but also to give new leaders in particular, or leaders doing new things, the opportunity to learn from my mistakes so that they don't have to repeat them. So really, I focus on change management and I love it.
That's awesome. And we connected because of your work in both a nonprofit setting and in a consulting setting, because I just admire what you do and wonder how you juggle it all and what advice you would have for me if I were to kind of imitate your path. That's great. So first I want to start with Interfaith Family Services. You were brought in as a change agent, right?
Yes.
Obviously, there were some things that the board recognized needed to be fixed or be done differently. But then I think when you got in there, as many of us find, sometimes The system is working exactly as it's designed to work,
Yes.
and it's very dysfunctional, but there's a lot of people committed to keeping that system going. Is that right?
That is absolutely right. So when I started at Interfaith, they had just celebrated their 25th anniversary. The founder was there for a long time, and then he actually promoted someone from within who was also there for a pretty long time, and then she decided to retire. So the organization was very close-knit, and I was the first real outsider that had ever came into the leadership role. I went through a series of interviews, and the board was really clear that they knew some changes need to take place, but not even they knew the extent to which the organization was struggling. Because I had a consulting background, the first thing I did was come in and complete an agency analysis, and that's when I figured out that we had a very sizable deficit, about a $2 million budget with a $500,000 deficit.
Oh my goodness, that's significant.
Yes, and we were already six months into the fiscal year, so that was a surprise that no one had mentioned in
Wow.
all the interviews. We had 40% success rate at the time, with 50% of those families being homeless again 6 months later.
Oh
Um,
no.
so it was a very challenging situation. But as I was 38 at the time, so as a younger person, I wasn't really taken aback by that. I was a little disappointed, but not taken aback by that. I think the thing that was most challenging to me was the resistance that I would get from the staff after trying to improve the organization. And so that was the most challenging part.
Right. What do you think, what do you attribute that resistance to when you come in and you see things that need to be changed, but the staff is kind of so set in their ways? What do you make of that?
Well, I think that when people come in to work every day, 8 hours or more, most feel as if they're doing the best they can. Very few people are going to say to themselves, "I'm only performing at about 60% of my capacity." When you get to particularly low performing organizations, it's steeped into the culture that whatever they're producing is the best they can produce. And so anything more, even if it's failing, let's say we go with the 60%, even if you ask, let's get to 70, that 10% increase in the workload, as they see it, seems to be just you're asking too much. And so that's the issue with organizations that have been low performing over a period of time, because no one's coming in and saying, "We're just kind of halfway doing it and seeing where we can go." That's No one would feel good about themselves under those circumstances. So they have psychologically convinced themselves that this is the way it is. We're doing the best we can. These are our obstacles. They're difficult to overcome. And so then you have this person coming in and saying, "We could actually do more, and this isn't really very productive, and we need to make these adjustments." It As much as you don't want it to feel like a personal attack, it feels personal, because it feels like I could have been operating in a different way, more successfully, more high performing, with better results. And they feel bad because either they didn't know they could, or that they feel bad because they haven't been doing it. And so it becomes very personal, even though it's not meant to be. And I think that's why change resistance is such a thing. I mean, we see it with our families. I'm sure you see it as well. We've had people come through our career training program, and we show them, "You know what, you actually could have a job making this much," and they burst out into tears. And they're not happy tears. They're tears like, "I've been struggling all this time and I didn't know it was possible. Gosh, I feel like an idiot." And it's like, "No, you just didn't know." And so I think that's kind of the same thing that happens when you come into an organization that's low performing and you start talking about the possibilities. People feel sometimes personally attacked just by the idea that they could have been doing more.
Yeah, it's a real defensive kind of mode that they get
Yeah.
into, right? So, how do you, as the leader, kind of break through that shell and that resistance and that kind of ego that gets in the way? What do you do to change that?
You know what? It's something I've learned, and this is kind of I'm not I don't th I don't think it's controversial, but it's kind of true. Low performing organizations have a lot of low performers. And so part of what you have to convince yourself and the board is that if you're going to make a transition, you're likely to lose some of them. Sometimes
Right.
it's not a matter of like transforming the people as much as it is identifying the people in the organization who are open to growth, who really want to see the mission, who come to life, who have been, they're always in a group like that, someone who wanted to do more, but they just didn't feel like they were supported. So you find those allies and you find those people and you invest in those people and you prepare everybody else from the board to the team themselves to say, I realize that this, the direction the organization is going may not be the direction that everybody wants to go, and that's fine. And so once you've made that adjust, made that, you know, had that conversation, I think it kind of gives everybody the ability to make their own decision. I think it's a mistake to come in and try to and to assume, particularly in low performing organizations, that you're going to be able to maintain the entire team and transform the organization at the same time.
So what you're saying is like one of the things I've said is going to be like engraved on my tombstone that sometimes subtraction is the best way to build a strong team, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You and as a leader, it's really important that you get comfortable with that
Yes.
not everybody belongs on your bus,
Yes.
and that it's okay for people to get off the bus. But I like what you said about preparing, you know, the board and people in advance, because that's super important. If you come on and all of a sudden 50% of your workforce just ups and quits or gets fired, like it's going to raise some questions, I think. But
Most
it can
definitely.
actually be like the healthiest thing for the agency.
Most definitely. And that's why I think having that analysis up front to really kind of tell the organization, the board, and even some of your key constituents, because I think these are conversations you need to have with your donors as well, at least your major donors, to say, hey, here's where we are, and here's where we're going, and you're likely to see the following as we get there. That way, when it appears, and I've learned, and I wish I had have known that. That's the one thing I wish I'd have known. Because when you tell, now that I do that, whether there's any transition going on, I prepare people in advance. When something happens, no one's, you know, shook by that. They're just like, okay, she said this is a possibility, and that's, you know, I know how to respond.
Yeah,
So,
that's really
yeah.
key, is preparing people in advance so that when it happens, nobody gets too nervous about what's going
Yes.
on.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but then I want to lean into something that you said just now. let's take a few seconds to talk about how this radio show is coming to you. KPFT takes no advertising dollars at all, and almost every one of the people who work to bring you the show are volunteers. Please call 713-526-5738 and press option one to become a sustaining member today. We are back with Kimberly. And she is talking about her organization, Interfaith Family Services in Dallas, and her consulting business, which is Kim Williams Consulting LLC. So you talked about just a few minutes ago about preparing people and getting ready and even preparing donors. Now, you went through some pretty rough waters when you first came on to Interfaith Ministries, and the way that you dealt with it with your donors, I was just like, yes, ma'am, that is like you did it perfectly. So explain the situation to us, and then we'll get into the donor thing in a minute.
Okay, so what happened was when it came time to, so before. When I did the agency analysis, I realized several things. We were a low-performing organization. At the time, no one in the organization had ever received a performance review, and there was a lot of training and maybe capacity gaps that we need to fill in. So I spent my first year providing training and working on culture development. And I told everybody at the start of the second year, we're going to have our first set of performance reviews. That's when, you know, everyone loved me during the training period. Everybody even loved the vision. They were excited to do something new, different, and more impactful. But when it came time for the accountability part, that's kind of when all heck broke loose. And so we had about a third of the staff go to the board chair at the time and come up with I'll never forget, it was a 40-page document
Oh my God.
full of untruths about me, my performance, what I was requiring, even accusing me of taking money. It was just, it was crazy. So I remember getting called in one day by the chair, not called in. She said she wanted to meet with me. And then all of a sudden the executive committee, everybody shows up. They didn't even know why they were there, but she pulls out this 40-page document and she proceeds to tell me all the things. And I'm
holy cow. Yes, how did you keep your composure in that moment?
Oh my gosh. It was really just God. Cause I remember afterwards being like, how did that happen? But I was thankfully it happened in my meet in my office. So it was like this accusation. And I was like, hold on just a second. And I printed like an email or a document to say, no, that's not true. Here it is. And this thing. And I was like, no, that's not true. And it was literally issue after issue after issue. I was able to say, no, we're actually doing this instead. And no, I actually raised wages for everyone at this point. And no, I actually just sent an email out last week that says, if you have PTO, please take it because you deserve to rest. And no, I did. They were like, what? And no, I actually have we called it Big Better Interfaith Group, where we had representatives from every department come together and they could anonymously provide feedback, suggestions, and all of that. And just give me whatever they had because I knew we were going through change. So anyway, by halfway through the list of accusations, the vice chair said, hey, can you step out for a minute? And so I did. And when I came back, he said, our apologies. You clearly should have been let in on this before these meetings took place. And so that part went well. But mm-hmm. whoever was responsible, and I specifically asked him, don't let me know who it is, because I knew I would have a hard time working with these individuals, knowing what they tried to do. So when that didn't work.
Can I just stop you right there and say, like, mad respect, because that shows an incredible amount of maturity and like confidence, but also knowing yourself.
Yes.
Which is, you know, a key leadership trait, but man, oh man, I can't imagine you practiced it so well in that moment.
And again, I think you make a good point, knowing yourself. Like I believe that I, you know, was mature as a individual and in my faith, but I'm not perfect. And so I knew that if I, you know, knew that such and such, who I've been meeting with and interacting with, has been, you know, part of this group, gosh, it would have been devastating and very difficult. So I said no to that, but. So the day that we had a meeting with the team and the board really backed me up at that meeting and said, you know, hey, we support the direction that she's taking the organization. The person who was responsible thought I knew, and she outed herself in the meeting and then resigned.
And it
was someone I felt one of the closest to at the organization. So it was devastating.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I kind of think she wanted my position, but I can't say for sure. So, okay. but I was, it was super devastating. So then the next year, whoever was responsible also decided that they were going to send anonymous letters to all of my major donors saying that I was stealing from the organization. And so every few weeks, another donor would call and say, hey, I received this letter. Can we talk about this? It was like mental warfare, because I never knew who was going to receive it. I never knew when it was going to happen. It was crazy.
That is like, I can't think of too many situations or too many people who wouldn't feel like that was the nightmare of all nightmares. And it is a nonprofit. I mean, all you've got is your reputation as
That's
a nonprofit
it.
CEO.
That's it.
It is it. All about your reputation. It is all about the rapport that you build with your donors, the way that they feel about, you know, the job you're doing with the money that they're investing into you. It is everything. So how did you, respond when?
And I think you make such a good point, because going into this job, I had a stellar reputation for every organization I'd worked for and every organization that I worked with. And I took my reputation seriously. So when this happened, it was like, gosh, this is really terrible. And so what I did is I ordered a forensic audit of our organization. We'd gotten annual audits, but I wanted an even deeper one. I had talked to my board and my executive committee. And whenever we ever got the letter, I brought the forensic audit. I usually had at least one representative from my executive committee present. And I talked them through my tenure, what I found when I came, the way that I invested in the team to give them an opportunity to either step up or step away, and then the results that happened as a result of that and kind of where we were moving. And just I just had an honest, vulnerable, transparent conversation with each and every donor that received that. And over the course, it was about a year to a year and a half that these things were happening, and then they finally stopped. But doing that, not only did we not lose a donor, nearly every donor targeted gave more money the next year.
Yeah, that's the part that that's the triumph, Kim, right there. That was the triumph. So, what do you think it was that made those donors trust you, believe you, and say, not only are we going to continue our support, we're going to increase it? What do you think that was?
I mean, you heard me already mention God. Like, I'm a super person of faith, and so I think I was just graced to be able to go in, and sometimes it felt like an out-of-body experience. I was able to go in, say the things that I need to say. With there has to be, I think, real courageous leaders and change agents have to have the mindset of, this job doesn't make me. If for some reason I lose this job, I'm going to be okay. I think so. Going in with that level of like, I'm not trying to convince you of anything. You have a choice as to whether or not you believe me, but I'm just going to tell you the
Here's the
truth.
facts,
Here are the facts. Here are the facts. Hopefully, you can see my heart in this conversation. And then I'm just going to have faith and trust God for the rest. I think that level of not trying to over persuade, not speaking negatively of the people. I never did that. I always said I understand how challenging it must be to have somebody from the outside come in and require so much more than what you've been doing. And I understand that, how people feel threatened when their back is against the wall, that they may lose their job. I get that tension. But at the same time, I'm called to carry out this mission. I never disparaged the people that were doing it. That was another thing. And I think that that's one of those things together really caused the people I was talking to have confidence in me and my leadership.
So looking back on that experience, like what did you bring forward with you? Like what did you learn from it, and how did it change you?
I learned the importance of not just strategy, but to really analyze the culture in which the strategy is taking place. That culture and strategy have to be aligned. And so that became really important to me, knowing when I go into organization, who the players are, who has the influence, both from a title standpoint, but also a non-title standpoint. Who's speaking to whom? The other thing is to set expectations up front. Not everyone's going to like this. Not everyone's going to agree with it. Not everyone's going to make it through the process. And then to have someone from the board level, especially if you think that's the way it's going to be present when you have that conversation, so that they know that the board sees what I'm seeing. The board has heard what I've heard. The how I'm rolling this out, we're all transparent on every level. So that it's going to be very difficult for you to say that it's something that it's not with all of us in the room. And I think so. So when you know that it's going to be challenging, make sure every key player is represented and that they see those communication channels flow up and down. So I think that's what I would do moving forward. The other thing that I would do, honestly, I would not try for as long to work with low performers. I wouldn't. I gave way too many chances. And I think that moving forward, I would have just said, this is not aligned. We're not, and just parted ways. I think if I had done that earlier, and used our budget issues, used all that weren't even personal to allow me to trim the fat, I should have done that then.
It's we always invest in people who we can see the potential in, but Sometimes we overinvest because if they
Yes.
don't want it as badly as we want it for them,
Yes.
then it's a waste of time and money.
It is.
Yeah.
It most
Yeah.
definitely is. And it just makes it harder when the time comes.
Well, Kim, I have like a million more questions for you, but we are running out of time.
Okay.
I would like to ask you two things. The first is, what advice do you have for other leaders out there who are facing similar situations? And then please tell us how listeners can find you, because I think this is going to give you a lot of people asking more questions.
So the other advice that I have, which is the reason why I consult, is get someone to come partner with you so the whole onus isn't on yourself if you can afford it. I think it helps when you're going to the board. I think it helps you to be able to have a different perspective. It also, honestly helps to have someone else to kind of share the blame for some of the
Exactly.
decisions that you have to
Oh,
carry.
yeah.
From a consultant standpoint, to say, hey, they identified X, Y, and Z, and it's not me attacking you. And so I think that so I if you can get help, get some help early on. But the other thing is bring your team together, be honest, be transparent, and be realistic. That's what I would suggest when you're going through that, and have grace for yourself. It's not a perfect walk. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to, hindsight's going to be 20/20. You're going to wake up every day and be like, I wish I had done this way and that the other way. But there's grace for all of that. So just
Right.
be gracious to yourself and others. And then in terms of how to reach me, I just encourage everybody to go to kimwconsulting.com to find out more about me and my services and my podcast.
Okay, KimWConsulting.com. We are out of time. I am so sorry. I have so many more questions and love to have you back at some point. But right
Sure.
now we're going to wrap it up. So I would like to thank my guest, Kimberly Williams. Amplify Houston is supported in part by The Cottage Shop, a thrift store located at 811 Westheimer Road in Houston, which is owned and operated by The Women's Home. Proceeds from The Cottage Shop help women reclaim their lives. Further information can be found at thewomenshome.org/cottageshop. Be sure to stay tuned for Gulf Streams with Weston Twardowski for the latest environmental and climate news in the Gulf Coast region and beyond. This is Anna Coffey with Amplified Houston, the Women's Edition, over and out.
It's now or never. Come hold me tight. Kiss me, my darling.
And we're live here outside the Perez family home, just waiting for the... And there they go. Almost on time this morning. Mom is coming out the front door strong with a double-arm kid carry. Looks like Dad has the bags. Daughter is bringing up the rear. But the diaper bag wasn't closed. Diapers and toys are everywhere. Ooh, but Mom has just nailed the perfect car seat buckle for the toddler. And now the eldest daughter, who looks to be about 9 or 10, has secured herself in the booster seat. Dad zips the bag closed, and they're off. Ah, but looks like Mom doesn't realize her coffee cup is still on the roof of the car. And there it goes. Oh, that's a shame. That mug was a fam favorite.
Don't sweat the small stuff. Just nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Learn more at nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
KPFT is supported in part by Democracy Now!, a 501c3, which is hosting a screening of Steal This Story on May 16th at the River Oaks Theater at 3:45 p.m. The film chronicles